I'm Liz Grossman.
I'm Rachel Gilman-Rischel.
And I'm Molly Each. You're listening to the Between Bites podcast, a nonprofit food-inspired storytelling series. We feature first-person stories from chefs, restaurateurs, writers, and others in the food and drink industry. Episodes are recorded live in Chicago bars and restaurants. We hope you enjoy.
So our next speaker was born and raised in New Orleans and picked up family recipes while cooking alongside his grandmother as a kid. He moved to Chicago in 2003 to cook at Narcisse. And in 2010, he joined the team as executive chef of Pioneer Tavern Group. He's best known for whole animal dinner service, game dishes with a southern spin, and grilled oysters served up at Frontier in Westtown. Please welcome Brian Jupiter.
How's everyone? All right. First of all, I want to say this was like a school project for me. It's been quite some time since I had to actually write a paper. So bear with me here. But like Liz said, born and raised in New Orleans, and the theme of being uprooted was something that, you know, kind of took me back a little bit because New Orleans is a place that a lot of people don't leave. This is, you know, I guess you had pre-Katrina New Orleans, but you know, people would stay there, and you would work there, and you raise your families there, and it's a culture that's like no other place, you know, in the United States and in the world, and in most regards. We do things kind of like our way, you know, whether that's the way you cook, the music we listen to, the way you bury people, the way you talk, you know, everything is completely unique to New Orleans. So the theme of Uprooted took me back to being a little boy, and I feel, you know, I was uprooted by a passion for culinary arts to actually get out of New Orleans and go and see something else and take my career to a different place. My grandmother, my mama, we call her, she was very influential in the way that I cook. Still to this day, the way that I think about food, what I expect food to taste like, the way that people season their food, no matter what the cuisine is, all goes back to my days, you know, being in the kitchen with my grandmother and eating her food. My very first interaction with a professional chef was a cooking class in New Orleans at the New Orleans School of Cooking. And so I was like, I don't know, 14 years old. My grandmother wins these tickets at her women's club meeting, and she's like, oh, we got to go to this cooking class. And so we go to the cooking class. We make three things. We make gumbo, we make a pineapple coconut bread pudding, and we made a red bean soup. And those three things still to this day are things that I make quite often. You know, we serve it at the restaurant from time to time. And little did I know that this was something that was going to, you know, really sprout my career and my culinary curiosity. Chef Elliot Roussel was the chef, and he was a very, you know, tall guy, worked at Brennan's restaurant, started as a dishwasher, worked his way to executive chef in one of the best restaurants in New Orleans. And I was just wowed, you know, and I knew at that moment, I'm like, okay, well, this cooking thing is you know, it's you can really be a professional and cook for a living. And so started high school. I got a job at a restaurant in New Orleans called Aurora Steakhouse. And it was a little mom and pop, you know, joint, but it was busy. One of my high school buddies got me the job. I was 16 years old. And so I was working fry station at this place, home of the all-you-can-eat catfish Thursdays. You know, I almost cried like one Thursday every month, you know. And so, being a kid, you know, like you're around like all the, you know, debauchery of a kitchen, you know, especially, you know, in the 90s, when that was, you know. And so my kitchen manager, his name was Dave, you know, he was like a 10-year vet at the place, hated his job, hated everybody that worked there, you know, during business hours. After business hours, you know, four Jack and Cokes in, he loved us all, you know. The other guy who worked next to me, real big black guy, name was Greg. And so Greg looked like he played football for the Saints every Sunday, and he was terrifying, you know. But he was an absolute beast on this grill. I mean, 30 steaks, different temperatures. He pumps it out, no problem at all. I'm over in the corner making sure my catfish is fried all the way and trying not to get yelled at, you know. But it really showed me, you know, like the real life kitchen, you know. And so you're, you know, a teenager, you know, with drunks and swearing and, you know, all these crazy things. And it just, it made me want it more. You know, I'm like, I really like this, you know. Like, I'm going to talk like this too, you know. And so from there, I spent a couple years there, and I started applying to culinary schools, and I was looking at all these different schools, and you're just like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to go culinary school, I'm going to open up my own restaurant, and it's going to take, you know, 3 years to do that. So off this culinary school I go. I picked Johnson & Wales in Miami. Went to rack me up some good old student loan debt, and started working in kitchens there, you know. And the first thing I realized in culinary school was that you really didn't know shit. And so, like, I went in, like, okay, I've been working in the restaurants, this is nothing, I know everything. So you teachers and stuff, y'all could kind of sit back and just let me do my thing. And so I was quickly scolded, you know, called a hack, and kind of brought me back down to reality pretty quickly. And so working in restaurants in Miami, you know, learned Spanish. I learned all these different types of cuisines, and I kept being attracted to Asian places. So like the first probably 4 or 5 places I worked, all these Asian inspired places. So I'm like, okay, I got to figure it out. I'm gonna be the first black Asian cooking chef, and I'm gonna do, like, you know, dim sum and all this stuff. And, you know, like, people gonna be like, oh man, this is crazy. How does he know how to cook this stuff? You know. And so one place in particular that stood out, and that's actually once I got over my Asian fantasy, I worked at a place called 190. And 190 was a tiny, like, little hole in the wall in Miami, and it was in Little Haiti. And Little Haiti, now if you go to Miami, they call it the art design district or something like that. But this was like Little Haiti, you know. It was crazy. You know, it looked like you were, you know, took a boat, you know. And and so it was this little small place, you know. It was Argentinian owners, husband and wife, tiny kitchen. The kitchen staff consisted of myself, the owner's sister, and probably the best dishwasher in the world. And so literally the hottest kitchen, you're talking 104, you know, 105 degrees, changing out chef jackets mid-shift. Lost a couple pounds, but they let me cook whatever I wanted to cook. And so they were just like, okay, look, as long as you keep it, you know, along these lines of, you know, Argentina, you know, then you can do whatever you want. And so that's when I really took things back, and I'm thinking about all these dishes that I would eat growing up and all the stuff my grandmother cooked for me. And, you know, New Orleans is full of good stuff. I mean, it's hard to find a bad meal, you know. And so I'm like, what am I thinking about this fucking soy sauce? And I'm like, I should be making, you know, the stuff that people travel from all over the place to go and get, you know. And so started putting, you know, shrimp and andouille and tasso and all these different things in play with the Argentinian flavors. And it's kind of when I started to find myself and you know, kind of figured out your style, you know. And every chef is different, and every chef, you know, plays with their food the way that they feel comfortable, you know. But I really found at that point that you got to stay true to your roots. And Miami was great, but it was time to move on. And I got a call from an old chef that I thought hated me to take a job in Chicago as his sous chef. And you know, I was young, you know, 22 or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, why not? You know, I'll move to Chicago. And so come to Chicago, 2003, you know, had never seen snow. Actually, I'd seen snow one time. Probably had never experienced weather under 30 and that was freezing, you know, and everybody's like, what are you doing? Like, you, Miami to Chicago? Like, you sure you want to do this? You know, but it was, I knew that it was going to be an experience that would challenge me. And so I moved to Chicago, ready to work with this chef. And I'm like, all right, man, look, we're going to do this thing together. And he leaves like a month after I get here. You know, he's like, he was living in Miami. And I mean, I think it was like the first snow. And he was like, listen, man, this isn't working out for me. I'm going to go back and get on a beach and work on this tan, you know. And so I was stuck with, okay, now who am I going to work for? You know, like I'm this, you know, 22-year-old or whatever. And I'm like, I can't let him bring another chef in because what if we don't get along? You know, then I just move all the way to Chicago and I'm fucked, you know. And so I go to the owners. The owners have no clue how old I am. They just think like I'm this big dude and whatever. He's probably been cooking forever. And so I go to the owners. I'm like, hey, listen, I think that I can take over, you know, for Jason. I can be the executive chef here. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, let me look at your resume again. And, you know, that was full of fluff. You know, you always fluff those resumes. You know, I was like, you know, chef day, yeah. You know, they give me the shot, you know, a couple tastings or whatever. And they're like, okay, yeah, you know, we like your food. And so they give me my shot. And so now the only problem is I don't know what I'm doing. So I got to figure it out. You know, you're figuring it out on the fly every single day. It's like, okay, don't make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you got to fix it before anybody knows that you made a mistake. And so I mastered that. So I was just like, okay, everybody thought that I just knew what the fuck I was doing. And so I go in the kitchen, you know, guns blazing, like, okay, guys, listen, we're going to change the menu. We're going to fix all this broken shit. We're going to, you know, buy new equipment. Oven was broken. And so the cook's like, no, don't worry about the oven. I'm like, well, we're only in a small kitchen, you know, we have one other oven, you know, like, I'll get the oven fixed, and then we'll be able to use it. Nah, chef, don't worry about the oven. So comes to find out, one of my cooks was selling dope, and so that was his stash spot, was the broken oven. And so, I mean, the guy still works with me today, but all my ovens work, though, all my ovens work, so no. Don't worry about that at Frontier. I always do work. It's hard to find cooks. It's hard to find cooks, you know. But eventually we got the oven fixed. We had a talk. Stayed there for a couple years and, you know, kind of fast forwarding through the, you know, through the Chicago life and, you know, making dumb decisions and quitting places too soon and getting a big head and battling my own ego and all that type of stuff. And it landed me teaching culinary school at Washburn Culinary Institute on the South Side. And that was an experience as well because I was younger than a lot of the people that were in the school. And so we had people that I was like, I'm not listening to you. Like, what? You don't know shit. Like, what? You know? And so, I literally had this lady, and she was an older woman, and I would you know try to get her to move faster and stuff. And she said, "Listen, I'm old enough to be your mama. Okay, you don't tell me how fast to move. You don't tell me what else to do, and we'll be fine." I said, "You know what? You're probably right. I'm gonna just leave you alone." Leave you alone. I'm gonna give you a C, but I'm gonna leave you alone. And so, working through all these places and finally finding my feet, I partnered up with the Pioneer Tavern Group and we started Frontier. So Frontier now is on its 7th year, feels like 17. And this was this whole concept of whole animal cooking and wild game. And so immediately everybody's like, oh, you hunt? I'm like, nah, I don't like bugs. And they're like, oh, well, you know, you probably like grew up cooking whole animals. And I was like, nah, I actually cooked probably 2 whole pigs in my life before Frontier. And I burned one of them, figured out the second one. So yeah, not that either. wild game, you know, you probably eat all this crazy stuff. And I was like, no, actually, my grandmother likes well-done steaks and wasn't very adventurous at all. So, I mean, to this day, I lie to my grandmother about what she's eating. If it's something weird, I'd be like, hey, that's just some chicken. Don't worry about it. I did a dinner in New Orleans and she came and she's like, listen, you know I don't eat all that crazy stuff. And I was like, I know, don't worry about it. She reads the menu. She's like, rabbit livers? And I'm like, that's not really rabbit livers. I just call them that. She's like, okay, you know. And so, and she loves liver, right? She loves fried liver, like chicken livers, beef liver. You give her any kind of liver, she's fine. But because it said rabbit liver, she's like, oh, I don't know. I don't eat that rabbit liver, you know. And so the whole menu, which was like all wild game, I had to tell her it was beef, it was chicken, it was rabbit. No, it wasn't rabbit. It was, you know, whatever, turkey. And she loved it all, you know. And I really, really had to learn on the fly again. And Frontier, again, took me back to my roots and putting some Cajun and some New Orleans twist on it really made me feel, you know, comforted. You know, it made things a little easier, you know. Kind of simplifying things and taking it back. And when we opened the place, we had no idea that we were gonna do, you know, 20 something whole animals a week. And, you know, it was like, yeah, like some asshole will probably get a pig for his birthday. Probably not, but you know, we'll put it on the menu. It's cool, you know, it's cool. You know, and so it turns out to be, I mean, that's like what we do. If we didn't do the whole animals, now we'd probably close down. But, taking it back, you know, to the roots, I'm opening another place that's going to be called Ina May. And Ina May is my great-grandmother. And so although I didn't cook a lot with my great-grandmother, she taught my grandmother everything she knew. So I'm like, it's like I cook with her. You know. And so Ina May is everything that New Orleans is. I mean, and every single item that, you know, that is solely, you know, indigenous to New Orleans will be here, and it's going to be done the way you would get it in New Orleans. And so I'm so excited about this concept because through the travels and all the, you know, the roller coaster of a ride that you take as a chef sometimes, I've always tried to do this concept. And so it's back to the roots. It's New Orleans as New Orleans could possibly be. And that's what my heart and soul has told me to do forever. Even though you try to venture off and change it and you know seek things that aren't really what you're destined to do, so that's my uprooted story. Thank you.
Our first reader is returning to Between Bites, and we're so excited that she's here. She got her start cooking at the Ritz-Carlton Chicago while in high school. That is so badass. And made her way to places like Le Francais, La Tour at the Park Hyatt in LA, and the Four Seasons in Chicago, Santa Barbara, and LA. Her first restaurant, Naha, has been honored with 7 consecutive Michelin stars, and she counts multiple James Beard nominations and awards among her many accolades. In 2013, she opened Brondi, which won a Beard for Best Restaurant Design in 2015. Please welcome Carrie Nahabedian.
You want to stand?
I guess I'll stand. Okay. So thanks for having me back. The first time I did it last spring, I had never been part of it. I knew a lot of friends that had done it, and I thought I was really intrigued by it. And I don't know what the theme was, but it was a lot of fun. And this one, Uprooted, challenged me for weeks on end. And today I tossed my whole speech away and rewrote it because I had an interaction today in the grocery store, and I thought maybe I should start out a little more reflective and then move into a little bit more humor about our life in general. So I would say that I am feeling very reflective because of everything that's happened in the last year. I think it goes without saying that 2017 was a challenging one for everybody. And so it's a perfect term. You know, I was thinking along the lines of vegetables and things like that when we first started, but we are living in a disruptive environment and economy. So we're constantly wondering what's going to happen next, right? We're all about the same thing. We're trying to figure out the so-called millennials. We're trying to figure out the yuppies. We're trying to figure out the older crowd, the younger crowd. Like, it just keeps going on and on. But really, it's all about life in general, I guess. But recently at the Bonche Awards, Michael Muser was the MC, and he made a joke that the whole auditorium was filled with chefs trying to figure out if their food was good or not. And because we're all so insecure, as you can figure out. And what do we need to change? And we're all so confident, and we're so powerful about how we feel about our food. But at the same time, if you have one slow day, you're like freaking out. Like, oh my God, I gotta change the tablecloth. I gotta change the water glass. Like, what's gonna happen? What do we need to do? What do we need to change? And it's reminds me of that skit in Saturday Night Live where it said daily affirmation that you have to say to yourself is, you know, what am I doing? How am I cooking? And everything like that. So I'm also talking about the recent newspaper article that a lot of women were in about what's going on with the kitchen culture that showed a side of our business that all of us are not too flattering. We're not real happy about how flattering it comes off or how lack of being flattering more so. But just in general, about the fact that our industry, like a number of other industries, we just need to do the right thing, and that the kitchen culture will need to change. And lately, my phone has been ringing off the hook because no one wants to know that you do a great job in the kitchen. They just want to know, how did you get abused in the kitchen? And that's just not really the cool thing to do, because women and men are in the kitchen, and men can tell just as many horror stories as women can do, I would say. But I told the story to the Tribune in our discussion about what really starts your career in cooking is that you have to have a base and you have to have a mentor. And I was very fortunate to have my friend when I was 17 years old, like you heard from Liz and the ladies, that I started cooking while I was in high school at the Ritz-Carlton. And I went to school at Main East, big high school in Park Ridge. I took the bus, the Skokie Swift, the L, and ran every day into the kitchen to start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Keeping in mind, I went to school and I worked six nights a week at school, at work. So it was fun. But I had a great mentor, Fernan Gutierrez, who also was a great mentor to like Sarah Stegner and Susan Weaver, George Mavaris. Like, he mentored more chefs than you can ever imagine. And he was French to the core. Like, if you looked at his picture, you would put it in the dictionary and right next to it would say French chef, because he had the big toque and the mustache and he was robust and he drank and he smoked and, you know, ultimately that's how he died, because he smoked three packs of cigarettes a day and said to me, I don't know, I guess I have like this cancer in my lungs and I don't know. And, you know, to the end, he was really, you know, really, really upbeat about everything. But he taught us how to be true to the school of gastronomy. He taught us that it takes just as long to do it the right way as the wrong way. And if you start compromising your food, you're compromising yourself, you're compromising the restaurant, you're compromising just about everyone along the line, and then it's gonna haunt you. So he taught me many, many life lessons. And he guided my career as a friend until his death 12 years ago. So very appropriately, he died on Bastille Day. And we went to visit him in Mexico City, because by then he was living in Mexico. And he just looked at us like, okay, what'd you bring me? Because I went with another chef and I pulled out a bunch of Bordeaux and some Burgundy because he was from Dijon, and my other friend pulled out a bunch of beer because he you know, he was like, I can't eat this hospital food. And they're like, not giving me beer. They're not giving me anything. He didn't understand the whole philosophy. And it didn't correlate to me until I'm sitting there watching him, saying to myself, this is a man that could just kick ass in the kitchen. And he's reduced to, you know, eating corn pudding and stuff like that. Like just awful, awful food. So while I worked for him, he always strived to be very, very upbeat. He was really hard in the kitchen, but he was a ton of fun. And I was making $4.45 an hour. And you thought that was a big deal. I was, you know. And I was working 48 hours a week, and I was in high school, like I said. And I can't remember how it happened, but one day I got the wrong paycheck. And there was a girl in the kitchen, and she was like a girl's girl, where she was very frilly and, oh, I can't do this and I can't do that. And the guys were, she was the weak link in the kitchen. And all, you know, I worked next to her, and I was constantly bailing her out. And the chefs that are in the audience will tell you, like, when we say you're in the shit, that means you're in the shit. Like, the last thing you need is somebody next to you that's worse off than you, and you got service to get ready. So we were constantly bailing her out. She was lazy, and she was kind of used her sex. So I guess I'm getting back to the uprooting of the whole sexual harassment and everything that everyone is dealing with that we shouldn't be dealing with, because we should just be doing the right thing all the time. So one day I got the wrong check. And I opened it up, and much to my surprise, she was making $6.10 an hour. And I was like, fuck, you know, I was so pissed off. And I'm 17, and though I might come off that I'm so confident and cool as a cucumber, but really, I am pretty shy. Hard to believe, but yes. So I was so pissed off that I left my station, which you never do, like, you never leave your station. And I walked up to Fernand, who was in the chef's office, and I tried to muster the courage, and I said to him that it wasn't fair that she, this girl, was, you know, look at this check. You know, I still remember it like it was yesterday. Look at this check. And he was pretty freaked out, because, you know, he probably went to the secretary of the food and beverage and fired her immediately for giving me the wrong check, because he knew it was going to cost the hotel the kitchen money. And he looked at me and he went, well, you know, she's a single mother, like that. And I looked at him and I went, so is that the way you're going to start this conversation? He goes, Okay, that's wrong. I shouldn't say that. I go, I'm just telling you right now, I'm not going to ever bail her out again. That this is the end. And now that I know that she makes $1.50 or $2 more than me, she's on her own, and she's going to float to the bottom of the cesspool that she is, right? And he said, okay, Carrie, I'm going to tell you something. You're only 17 years old, but I'm going to tell you that the sky's the limit for you. This girl, that's all she's ever gonna make. She's, don't even worry about it. I want you to know that your great things are gonna happen to you. You're gonna be a great chef. You're gonna do what you love, because this is your passion. This is what you love to do. And I looked at him and, you know, yes, I wanted to believe that, but at the same time I knew it was complete bullshit, that he was just wanting me out of his office, in the kitchen, setting up my station and getting ready for service. But that was the thing about Fernand that I'll get back to later on, is that if he brought you in the kitchen, no matter who you were, if you were a server even something, he brought you all the way down here, you never left there. He brought you all the way back up, because you gotta be happy when you're, especially in our environment. If a cook is unhappy, you don't want them cooking your food, because they're gonna take it out on all, you know, they're gonna take their frustrations out on the food, and they're gonna be unhappy, and you're gonna taste it. So a lot of times when you go to a restaurant and you're wondering what's there's nothing really wrong with the food, but there's nothing really, something's missing. It's called love. It's called that passion, and it's not just a recipe. It's what you're putting into it. But getting back to the uprooting of society for a moment, I went to the grocery store today because we had a guest that requested something that we didn't have, some red pears. So I had walked by the Jewel and seen that there was some red pears in the window. And while I was standing in line, I'm not a grocery store shopper. I hate grocery shopping, the whole paying for the bag, the checkout line, the bag tax, just this whole idea, you know, how would I get the groceries home? I just hate grocery shopping. So I usually grocery shop like one item every once in a while. Like, oh, I need some detergent. Oh, I might need some milk. But I never like go to the store and buy all this food because I don't have children, so I don't have to worry about that. But there were three guys in line in back of me, and they were like 31 years old, and it was lunchtime. And I said to myself, this is what all of us are wondering, how do we write a menu to cater to everyone? And these three guys, one guy had a tub of Sabra hummus with mini pita, and he's holding it. And I'm like, oh God, he's gonna eat it at his desk. The other guy had a, he had a snackables, like that you get at McDonald's or something like that. And I'm looking at, and the other guy, well, he was okay, because he had a tub of potato salad and what looked like chicken salad. But I want to turn to him and say, you know, there's 140 restaurants in River North, like within 100 feet of where you're standing. And I'm trying to create a lunch menu that caters to those three guys right there. So I came back to work, and I took my speech and I threw it away, and my sisters work for me, but my middle sister saw me and she looks at me, she goes, are we gonna have to, you know, I'm not allowed to go to the post office anymore because it frustrates me. So she goes, are we gonna have to not let you go to the Jewel anymore? And I said, come on, these guys, you know, they all look like they had money, and this is what they're eating at a desk. And I find this so unsettling that where's the civility? As I can't even imagine eating at the desk. Okay, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're pushing out, you know, late at night, sometimes I stay and everyone's gone home. Okay, maybe I make a Greek salad and I eat it because I'm sitting at my own desk and I'm alone. But I can't imagine sitting in a whole environment when they could come to like Bad Hunter and eat something that probably cost them the same amount of money. But my desk at work is kind of just filled with tape, filled with great quotes of things that I've collected over the years and years. And I just, it's no rhyme or reason. I just put them down, I put a piece of tape over it, and I move on, right? Or cool pictures. But my favorite recent quote, which I failed, I showed it to so many people that I lost it, and now I don't have it, was about, so I'm paraphrasing, and it was a designer, developer, architect who was talking about if you base your business model around the millennials or people that are trendy or hot or the newest concept, which I hate that word concept more than I hate baked, you're not going to succeed because these individuals, they're like snakes. They just go where the next warm spot is. So you're constantly going to chase a trend. You're constantly chasing a new concept, so to speak. So those three gentlemen kind of changed my course of my conversation. But I also would be amiss if I didn't bring up the fact that the world lost the greatest chef in the world this weekend. And, you know, Tom Brady's called a GOAT. Well, in our world, Paul Bocuse is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. What's hard to believe in what the Europeans do is that it's so incredible for us to think about that the man was almost 92 years old, and his bedroom above the restaurant was the same bedroom that he was born in. He died and was born in the same bedroom. And that's how great the French culture is that their whole idea of hospitality, they would never sit at their desk and eat, let's just put it that way. And they would never walk down the street drinking a Starbucks or anything. But I met Bocuse many times, so I'm just gonna tell you a couple of funny stories that he came to Naha, and he came twice to Naha with Chef Jean Bonchet, and it was very magical because as impressive as he is, he's honored by the President of France, let's just put it that way. He still took the time to go into the kitchen, introduce himself to every single cook, and then check their mise en place. Like, walked around, looked at everyone's mise en place, checked the quality of food and everything like that. But he loved America. So he loved American cuisine. So when he came to Chicago, a number of times he came for Bonchet, for the Bonchet Awards, the Bocuse d'Or finals. He ate at Trotter's many times. When he'd go to Frontera to eat Mexican food because there's no Mexican food in France. And he didn't want anyone to cook him French cuisine because, really, you're going to cook him French cuisine? So he wanted Armenian food. So I always would have maybe an hour notice that, you know, chef would call me up and say, oh, Bocuse is in town, we're going to come, and he wants to eat Armenian. So I want you to make a bunch of Armenian food. So I was like, okay. And he loved women. He loved women in the kitchen. He loved seeing Leah Linser was the first woman and only woman to date that's won the Bocuse d'Or from Luxembourg. And he would marvel at all the flavors of the Armenian cuisine. And this is a man that has had 3 Michelin stars continuously since 1965. And we all sweat the Michelin stars, so just imagine 1965, he's had 3 Michelin stars, and the longest in history. But I had friends that recently ate there, and he was still in the kitchen. At 91 years old, maybe he's not making the breast chicken or whatever, but he's still in his toque, he's still dressed up. So I met him many times like that, but I'm going to tell you a quick story about Mexico City. So I was the chef at the Four Seasons in Los Angeles, and Fernan Gutierrez, my mentor, was director of food in Mexico City at the Four Seasons. And he called me and he said, I need you to come to Mexico City for a couple days, and I want you to change my menus, teach the cooks, do a promotion, you know, rattling off. And I'm like, a couple of days? Like, what does that mean? He said, well, you know, the cooks can't come to, they can't come to the United States because it's Mexico. So I want you to come here and do all the stuff you do and talk to them and get them motivated. And I'm like, except I don't speak Spanish, you know? So we ended up staying 2 weeks. We ended up staying 2 weeks, but I brought my chef, my restaurant chef at the time was Kevin Hickey, who you all know from the Duck Inn. So Kevin, you always want at your side because number one, he cooks really great food and he's a lot of fun, but more importantly, he cooks great food. So he knew my food, he knew my style, and he also was enthralled with Fernan. He had like a bromance with Fernan because Kevin's a big guy, Fernan was a big guy, and Kevin spoke Spanish. So here was my liaison. So we get to Mexico City, we get to the Four Seasons, and there's Fernan holding court in the bar, smoking, drinking, having everyone around him because it's Mexico and you get to do all those things. And he walks in and the first thing he says to us after saying hello is, I need you to stay another week because Bocuse is coming and you have to cook for him. And I just looked, and Kevin at this time had a Cuban cigar in his mouth and a tequila, and he promptly went in the bathroom and threw up because he was so nervous. And I'm looking for him, and he comes out, and he's like, I can't do it. You know, he's, remember, this is Kevin, you know, 20 plus years ago. This isn't Kevin right now, who would be like, yeah, no sweat, I can cook for Bocuse. So Kevin, ever since he met Fernand, how Kevin met Fernand was through me, but Banché brought Fernand to Los Angeles when I was there to go to Pritikin to get healthy, because Fernand was going to die if he didn't. And he escaped from Pritikin and Banché and found a car to take him to the Four Seasons, came into the kitchen, plunked right down in the office, and said to Kevin, feed me some food before I die of eating healthy food. And that's how the bromance started, because Kevin just kept feeding him. And so I guess what I really want to tell you about is that Fernand was my coolest guy on the planet kind of guy. And he's the reason why I didn't have a problem in the kitchen, because he'd come to me and say, if anybody comes near you, you come talk to me and I'll take care of them, right? And we had a mutual admiration, and I could tell you stories for weeks and weeks on end about Fernand, because he was such a tremendous presence, and the city is really misses somebody like him. And one time he was best friends with Jean-Claude Polavie, who's gone, and Banché. And you know, we were talking about this at the Banché Awards after on Sunday, that there needs to be, what's sad about Bocuse dying is that half the cooks in Chicago probably don't even know who Paul Bocuse is. Now, if you ask them who Ferran Adrià was, or who Luis Andonez or something like that, they're all gonna know. But Bocuse, it's out of their realm. And it's the same with Banché. But one day Fernand called me up and said, hey, meet me up at Jean-Claude's restaurant. And if you guys kind of remember, up on Clark Street by the old Jerome's, up on Fullerton, Jean-Claude had his original, before Le Bouchon, before La Sardine, it was Jean-Claude's. And that was the hangout for all the chefs. And unbeknownst to me, Fernand's wife was in the hospital in labor with their first child. And Fernand just calls me and says, come meet me. And I was the chef at the Four Seasons, so I was like, okay, I'll jop over. And there's Fernand drinking his usual three bottles of red wine at lunch, and course after course, and tons of cognacs. And then he nonchalantly mentions that someone mentions, Jean-Claude says, hey, how's Carol? When's the baby due? Oh, she's in the hospital now. And we're all looking at him like it's the middle of the afternoon. And he says, well, the doctor told me to go get some lunch, that it was going to be a while. And I looked at him, I go, he meant for you to go to the cafeteria. He didn't mean for you to go to Jean-Claude and have a whole, you know, tasting menu and wines and cognacs. And he said, well, then the doctor should have been a lot clearer, because I'm French, I don't eat cafeteria food. So he got back just in time to see his baby born. And you know, we laughed about it all the time. And because it's stories like that that makes our job so great, that that we, at the end of the day, when it's so hard and it's so rough, I think about Fernand all the time. I think about Banché. I think about the times that you met so many great chefs who influenced you. And one being Bocuse, that he was just a cool, you know, this was a guy that had instant name recognition everywhere in the world, but he was the type of guy that still walked around and asked you why your hummus tastes different than everybody else's. And in our kitchen at Naha, on the clock, it still there's a sticker that he put on it that says, Bocuse. And, you know, we still have all the pictures of him and things like that. But in a light moment, I told him that my father was in World War II. And he was in France, and he was at Normandy, and he was shot in the war, and he was combat wounded, and, you know, the resistance saved him, and he was part of the liberation of Paris and everything. And he grabbed a menu, and he signed it. And it was, like, to my friend Mark, from, like, one soldier to the other, because Bocuse was in the war. And last year was a really difficult year for me, more so than ever, uprooting, if we're going back to the uprooting, because I lost my father last year. And earlier last year, when I did the talk, I talked about how we went to Normandy and the funny escapades, but my father died 73 years after being combat wounded in World War II as a direct result of his wounds. And I did a whole thing where I just, my mother said, your dad's not feeling well, I need you to come and help me. So I flew down to Florida thinking, I was just gonna go for a couple of days, not thinking that my couple of days would turn into a month. And once my dad saw me there, it was like the greatest hit list. So while you're here, Carrie, can you make me those stone crab dish that you know I love? So every day, that's all I did. It was cook. And I think it was a really great feeling for me that I couldn't heal him. I couldn't make him better, but I can make him soup butt egg, and the Armenian, his favorite dish, and I can make him stone crabs. And I could take him grocery shopping because he loved grocery shopping. He loved to look at every piece of fruit. I could make him crab cakes. I could do all those things. And when he was in the hospital recovering from surgery, he would look at the food and then he'd look at me and then I knew. I'd go to my mother, I'll be back. Give me 20 minutes, I'll be, where are you going? You know, and I'd go, no, you can't do it here. And I'd go out and I'd find the equivalent of a Portillo's and find him hot dogs and Italian beef sandwiches and French fries and all these things. And I'd bring him back to him and the nurses would look at me and the doctors and my dad would go, I have two stents in my heart. I'm not gonna die of a heart attack. I'm gonna die of something else. Let me eat what I want. And I think that that's what I was reverting back to Fernand, that when you're sick like that, you revert to the things that make you feel very, very comfortable. And I can tell you that with my father, the last business trip I took before I opened Naha with Four Seasons, we went to Paris and we went to Istanbul. And I took my dad with me and he met Ducasse and he met Gerard Boyer and the guys at Taivant and Lucas Carton. He met all the great three-star Michelin chefs because he spoke French. My dad spoke French. And he would tell Gagnier, you know, I like your food better than Ducasse. And I'd be looking at him like, okay, that's not cool. You can't say stuff like that. So here I am watching my dad in the hospital and we talk about the great foods that we dined on. And he said, you know, what it's all about, Carrie, it's what you always say. And that's how I'm going to end it, is that what makes our job so great is that we get to go into our kitchen every single day and do whatever we want. So if I want to come into the restaurant and cook Indian food for myself, I could cook Indian food. Or I can do whatever I want because we get to create every single day. And I know it sounds corny, but in reality, we're so lucky that we get to cook for people like yourselves every single day with memories of people that were there way before us. So I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about us at between-bites.com and follow us on social media as Between Bites.